are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
Children's International is working to end child poverty around the world by giving kids access to a safe place, a team, and a path out of poverty by focusing on health, education, empowerment, and employment. Together with people like you, we're more than a nonprofit. We're a powerful force for change. Learn more at children.org.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, November 21st, 2016. I am Michael Brooks on a Michael Monday, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Trita Parsi, the head of the National Iranian American Council, on the Iran deal, MENA, strategy for the Middle East region, in the age of Donald Trump. Is there any hope whatsoever? And what would a strategy devised by a sane person be? We'll talk with Trita about that and more. The era of clown fascism is upon us, and it's showing more fascism than clown, but still showing both more by the day, as a flood of dangerous bigots are given top positions in the bureaucracy of the United States. It's something beyond the typical traditional Republican goals of making America poorer, sicker, and dumber. It's the next level. It's Breitbart governance. And we'll talk about the rise of the alt-right, alt-righters, white supremacists in Washington, D.C., celebrating their victory, their seat at the table. We'll talk about what defines the alt-right, the different factions that make it up, where Steve Bannon is right, and how that makes him even more deeply dangerous. That's right. When it comes to Wall Street, they've tapped the vein. We'll talk about that. Rand Paul says no John Bolton. And John McCain says no waterboarding. We're still going to critique those guys with everything we have because they're ridiculous. But this is an all-hands-on-deck time. Violence in North Dakota as protesters against the pipeline are brutally suppressed by police and private security forces. That is still happening. Bernie Sanders says we need to get class-based politics to save the Democratic Party. How do we integrate that with a deep understanding of the threats of racism, sexism that are defining the current moment in America? And Chuck Schumer, at least intellectually, gets it, even if he is still the senator from Wall Street. And voters in Milwaukee who didn't vote, mainly African American, some of it was voter suppression, but a lot of it was disgust, and why those issues need to be handled, and why they're much more important to understand than the Trump voters. It's the non-voters. All that and more on today's Majority Report. Let's just go really briefly to North Dakota. Protests, do you have that, Matt? Protests are ongoing there. The pipeline is still set, obviously, for completion. It's going forward, and Native Americans, along with many allies, are there to protest basically on behalf of two essential things. One, this is already a community that has been environmentally ravaged, and it's a form of essentially private enterprise, state-supported neo-colonialism, which continues the long history of repression and horrific treatment of Native Americans. It also goes through sacred sites. Local law enforcement officials turned water cannons on protesters. This is in a long rave of significant abuse that we have already seen. They claimed that there was rioting. Nothing seems to indicate that except for disciplined, peaceful protest, as we've seen from the beginning, and people putting their bodies on the line. Let's take a look at this tape from digital smoke signals. It's water cannon being used on water protectors in North Dakota last night. There's no audio, but you can see that the contrast between the spin and the media representation from these oil companies and these thugs are completely misaligned with the reality of what's happening there. This is high-pressured water hoses on nonviolent protesters who are trying to protect their water. And I don't think I need to explicitly spell out the times in, you know, American history that this represents. So to see this happening at a moment when a Dixiecrat is being nominated to be attorney general, when bigotry in all of its forms are, you know, at the forefront, Standing Rock is a great example of why there's no contradiction between an understanding of the need for real, robust, powerful anti-corporate politics and the danger posed by corporations in all forms to all human beings in the United States and the persistent legacies of tremendous violence as targeted towards racially marginalized and repressed communities. Sorry? Okay. Now, I will take a moment because that would be a really awkward transition, frankly, to get to the next ad that I want to tell you about. So I'll take a slightly less awkward transition and say I had a good weekend. It was very busy. I tried to minimize my news content to some degree. Obviously, couldn't entirely.
I failed at that miserably.
You failed at that miserably. You have the look of a man who took in too much news over the weekend,
yeah.
Matt.
Yeah. I mean, when this, I was going to relax last night, and then all of a sudden, this started happening, the water cannons. And it's a shame because, you know, the police are running with this line that the protesters are getting more desperate. Well, the reason that they're getting more desperate is because that they're continuing
to
build.
They're being violently oppressed and abused while they're continuing to construct a pipeline that threatens their basic well-being and heritage.
The federal government told them to pause building, and they're just like, no, we don't need to wait for this new thing. So, like, it's and I think that, again, people need to focus on this energy transfer partners, like this corporation that's doing this. They're the ones who are escalating this right now.
It's pure thuggery. Kelly, how was your weekend?
I had success with avoiding media because I hid my phone and
that's smart.
My laptop died. Well, it was smart, except for I ended up missing some messages that, you know, maybe my family would have. But it's fine. But so that felt good, and then I got back online, and you have like 1,000 Twitter notifications, and you're like, oh dear God, what has happened?
And then you're just like, mute.
This is just really, yeah.
I want to talk to you about movement watches because there's no other way to transition to it other than to just tell you about them. They are making me want to get back into the watch game. The company was started by two broke college kids that wanted to wear stylish watches but couldn't afford them. So they started their own watch company. This is like the way the Majority Report was built in many respects. Bottom-up, internet-enabled. Movement watches start at just $95. At the department store, you're looking at $400 to $500. Movement figured out that by selling online, they're able to cut out the middleman and retail markup, providing the best possible price. Classic design, quality construction, and styled minimalism. I think we should all sort of aspire to styled minimalism. Over 500,000 watches sold in 160 countries. Get 50% off today with free shipping and free returns by going to movementwatches.com. And that's actually, I believe, what is the spell? I think it's actually like mvmtwatches.com/majority. mvmtwatches.com/majority. There'll be a link to it on the blog post. This watch is really clean design. And seriously, you get a lot of compliments on it. I know that Sam gave it to his wife, and she's been loving it. Now is the time to step up your watch game. Go to movementwatches.com/majority and join the movement. And let's also talk about information. And that brings us to texture. This time of year, everyone is traveling. but there's no way you're going to cram all of the magazines you want to read into one carry-on bag. It's true. And now you can with Texture, the app that gives you an unlimited access to 200-plus magazines. Texture has gone beyond just delivering the magazine itself. They made it easier to find and enjoy the articles that you, personally, you want to read. So as an example, I never miss a Matt Taibbi. I like Rolling Stone in general, but I'm a Matt Taibbi reader wherever he is and wherever I can find him. With daily recommendations, exclusive interactive features, videos, and more, Texture is searchable and you can mark what you like. Check out back issues, view bonus video content, and even curate articles and magazines just for you or whoever you're giving Texture this year. Why on earth would you just subscribe to a couple of magazines when you could have all the best ones in your smartphone or tablet all the time for way less? Okay, and you know, as I've said before, I have National Geographic, which I really love to look at, fascinating articles in the environment, Anthropology, Esquire, Rolling Stone, Fast Company for Two Dope Boys and a Podcast, Vanity Fair, Dwell, which looks amazing, GQ, New York Magazine, bunch of magazines that I look at. Texture now is offering Majority Report listeners a 14-day free trial when you go to texture.com/majority. That's a 14 days to try Texture for free. When you go to texture.com/majority, that's texture.com/majority, link on the website. And many of you listening to this show might run a small business or need to be looking for good employees. And that's why I'm going to ask you, are you hiring and do not know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Posting your job in one place isn't enough to find all quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job at all job sites at once, and now you can. ZipRecruiter has over 9 million resumes. You can search through their database. You can add multiple people to your account to make it most efficient for your team to find the best hire. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites, including social media networks. This is really crucial, like Facebook and Twitter. I definitely know people who have found gigs through social sites. That's a brilliant, important feature. ZipRecruiter is a search engine for finding and posting jobs. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. If you have any issues, ZipRecruiter's friendly and human, underscore human, support staff are ready to help. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 1 million businesses as featured in Forbes, Wall Street Journal, Time Magazine, The New York Times, TechCrunch, and CBS. ZipRecruiter's website shows trending career fields, cities, and searches. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. And one more time, because you always got to repeat it three times. ZipRecruiter.com/majority. There's a link to it on the website. We will be right back with Trita Parsi on the Majority Report. Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Trita Parsi. He is the president of NIAC, the National Iranian American Council, and author of the forthcoming book, Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. I hope I got that right, Trita.
You did.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. This is a very important time on a number of fronts. Before we get to the specifics of Iran and MENA in the Trump age, give everybody a brief refresher on really, frankly, how successful the Iran deal has been.
Well, let me put it this way. When was the last time you saw on TV a debate, a discussion about whether the United States should bomb Iran or not, and whether Iran was essentially already in possession of a nuclear bomb or not? I would guarantee you that you haven't heard that conversation on TV for about a year and a half. And the reason why you haven't is because of the Iran deal, because it put a stop to the pathways that Iran had to a bomb. And as a result, it also put a stop to the march towards war that actually was very, very active up until that point.
That's right.
And that's simply because that deal evaded two disasters in one. It evaded the war with Iran, but it also evaded the disaster of an Iranian nuclear bomb. So it's been working quite brilliantly thus far. Of course, the deal has an expiration, but over the course of the next year, the incentive structure of all of the actors can arguably be changed in such a way that the deal will be able to be successful beyond the next 10 years.
So, Trita, this, you know, one of the things that the success of the Iran deal exposed, I think, also was, you know, there's a broad spectrum of opinion. So someone like me, I would say, was always very, without having any, you know, indulgence for human rights abuses in Iran, without certainly being enamored of the Iranian system, I never had any doubt that there could be a deal made and that it was the sensible, smart, and strategic, ethical thing to do. Then I think there are people who probably had a lot more skepticism of someone like you or I, but were willing to be convinced by facts on the ground. And what we've seen with the success of the deal is the people who are just committed to warmongering as an end in and of itself are standing very exposed. And the paradox of the Trump presidency and the incredible danger of it, but I also want to give light to, you know, you identify the opportunity and the sort of paradox of it. On one hand, this is an administration, incoming administration, that's elevating people that certainly rhetorically are like Michael Flynn, who's called for a regime change in Iran. You know, very radical, very extremist people who don't want to take yes for an answer, it seems, with Iran. Now, on the other hand, Trump himself is a guy who's, you know, constantly talking about deal making. He's acknowledged, as you say, that Iran and the United States are at least synchronized, at the very least, when it comes to fighting ISIS or ISIL. So there's a paradox of an empowerment of definitely some of the most dangerous radical people in American foreign policy. But on the other hand, at least rhetorically, and I sense that you're trying to speak to this, a willingness to at least consider less U.S. engagement in abroad and maybe not breaking what's clearly working. So am I setting the stage for you right there?
I think it is, and I think what you're pointing to is that, you know, we really don't have a very good idea of exactly the direction that Trump will go. Clearly, a lot of the things that he's been saying, a lot of the people that he's been appointing are not particularly encouraging on many different fronts. But we don't know yet, and one thing that I think has happened over the course of the last 10 days when it's become clearer and clearer who the people are that he's considering to hire, is that he actually may end up being the most reasonable person in his cabinet.
Right.
Because some of these other people, and that's a big statement in and of itself, because some of these people are really quite concerning.
Terrifying.
And on the issue of foreign policy, that's where I think we see the biggest contradiction. And what explains the contradiction is that he seems to be hiring people based on their loyalty, mm-hmm. rather than on their merits and what if their viewpoints are particularly compatible with his. Because he's arguing that he doesn't want to have a confrontation with Russia. He's arguing that his criticism against the deal, to be frank with you, if you scratch the surface a little bit, it often ends up being that he is upset that the deal did not include lifting of sanctions on American companies. Mm-hmm. That it only lifted sanctions on other companies, but U.S. businesses, including his businesses, are not allowed to do business with Iran despite this deal. And this is something he's pointed to several times. And then, of course, his position on Syria, in which he's against arming rebels. He doesn't trust those rebels. He doesn't trust our ability to be able to vet those rebels. And he wants to go after ISIS as his first priority. And it's also been kind of interesting that when he's been talking about who's fighting ISIS, he's mentioning Russia. He's mentioning Iran. He's mentioning Assad. Right. He does not mention a single country that is part of the U.S. coalition fighting ISIS.
Right.
Now, he says these things. His advisors, almost exclusively, are all on the opposite side of all of those positions that he's taken. Michael Flynn and them are not in the position of, being particularly supportive of the Iran deal or viewing it only from the perspective of what it does or doesn't do for U.S. businesses. His position on Syria, as well as the other people within his coalition, including Mike Pence himself, who Donald Trump threw under the bus during one of the debates, in which he says, I disagree with Pence on this issue of Syria. And Syria obviously is a very important issue. So it's extreme uncertainty that we're dealing with here. Is he going to be a president that simply outsources all of the governing and policy to the people that he hires? Yeah. Or is he going to be the type of person that his ego is just so big that he doesn't tolerate them coming in with their own opinions? They're coming in because they're loyal to him and they're going to do what he says. So it remains to be seen.
Yeah, and that's obviously, it goes without saying, like with everything else, there's a tremendous amount of innate danger and uncertainty in it. And it's something, you know, it's kind of amazing that sort of the global system rests on the whims of a narcissist. But I want to ask you then, and we will get to Syria, but there's a paradox in Iranian foreign policy making an Iranian projection on the world. I think in the United States, obviously going back, and you know, rightly so from a U.S. perspective, I mean, there's a lot of bad blood in this relationship. From an Iranian perspective, they know about, you know, our support of obviously the coup against Mossadegh and our meddling and interference there. That forms their opinion. What forms many people's opinion here is the hostage, you know, the hostage taking. And so there's this image of Iran as, in terms of its projection, you know, very belligerent, very anti-U.S. We see burning flags and all the rest. Under Rouhani and his foreign minister, we've been exposed in the last couple of years to a very different part of not only Iranian foreign policy, but really Iranian, you know, culture, in fact, that is very like the height of diplomacy, the height of sort of conciliation, being conciliatory. And what I wonder is, and I know that, you know, the statements so far from people like Rouhani have made sense in the sense that they've, you know, they've been quite critical of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton as well, for that matter. But I'm wondering if these are savvy people. They know they're dealing with a guy who simply needs constant ego massage. They might actually be poised to do that in terms of their direct bilateral statements to him.
Could very well be. The position they've taken so far is that they've kept things open. They've tried to look at it from a glass half full rather than glass half empty. I think to a certain extent it is a bit of wishful thinking and a bit of their very, very negative view of Hillary Clinton shining through rather mm-hmm. than them actually assessing Trump objectively.
Right.
But his positions on Syria in particular, I think, has given them a bit more hope that perhaps this is a person they can deal with. The Iranians do tend to have a view that as long as there is a Republican president who wants to do business, they can deal with him, whereas they're more concerned about a president, Republican or Democrat, that comes in with strong ideological views. And if there's anything we can say about Trump is that he doesn't seem to have an ideology whatsoever. He doesn't even seem to think at that level of, you know, even putting together an ideology. Mm-hmm. So they've been keeping the door open, sending signals that if they're treated with respect and if there's no threats, they can collaborate, they can explore these different things. And again, it's a approach based on the assumption that it is Trump that will decide these things and not the people around him. We have a counterexample. We have the example of George W. Bush, who came in and during the campaign in 2000, he spoke about the need of making sure that the U.S. did not engage in nation building. He wanted less involvement abroad. He was almost an isolationist in the view of some. And then we saw that after 9/11, he became a reflection of his foreign policy advisors, who had spent so much more time thinking about these things and having much more dedication to their own views than George Bush had. With Trump, it remains to be seen. I doubt that he has that much dedication to his views, to be frank with you, because he doesn't seem to think about these things particularly profoundly. But he also has a very big ego, and as a result, once he says something, he may just stick to it just for the sake of it.
Right. Right. So there, it's almost like an even more kind of primitive, you know, I can almost see from an Iranian perspective, being like, you know, if they could somehow sort of float like, hey, I think, you know, Mike Flynn has been really disrespectful to you. And, you know, he says the right things, but yeah. I don't think he's, you know, like, I actually think that's the type of thing that from a domestic and international, you know, perspective, people actually need to think about doing from a kind of psyops perspective. So let's go to, I mean, it's kind of funny in this totally terrifying way, but it's also true.
It is. I mean, yeah. We know, for instance, the U.S. had a couple of tricks that it played on Arafat. They knew that Arafat just loved the red carpet. Right. And whenever they had problems with him, they knew that just an invitation to the White House, red carpet, treating him as a world leader, went very, very far in softening his position.
Right. So they should just be like, hey, you want to open a hotel?
Similar types of measures with Trump.
Yeah, you want to open up an amazing, tremendous hotel in Tehran. And by the way, like Mike Flynn, not a good guy, not respectful. Let's go to Syria then for a couple of minutes, because that's this fault line that has already been opened. And this is already, you know, Obama, I think, in some ways has managed it well with regards to Iran. He's also almost really capitulated with to the Saudis in other ways, which are incredibly destructive and problematic in my view, as in Yemen as an example. But we're in the paradoxical situation where, as you said before, in some ways Russia, Iran, Assad, they're probably more serious about fighting ISIS than some of our Gulf allies, at least in the initial stages of the conflict. But at the same time, obviously, Iran, Russia, Assad are also complicit in, you know, very serious human rights abuses. And I just think that needs to be on the table as
Absolutely.
Well, as are, you know, Absolutely. In fact, all other actors in this horrific situation. But the deeper dynamic that you point to is that this sort of Saudi-Iranian proxy war needs to stop in the Middle East in order to cool the region. And that really does need to be the kind of strategic aim of U.S. foreign policy. So it's not to alienate and sideline the Saudis, but it is to balance and recalibrate that relationship. So if you could just sort of speak to that and what could be done if we were acting rationally.
It is about recalibrating. It's also about kind of making clear. I mean, this is what I hope would happen. I think the administration's position in general, the overarching geopolitical goal was a correct one, and that is one that essentially says the United States needs to pivot to Asia. Mm-hmm. The reason for that is because the peer competitor to the United States, meaning a state that actually can challenge the U.S. on a global level, will not emerge out of the Middle East. It will emerge out of Asia. And the more the United States is allowing itself to get bogged down in strategically marginal conflicts in the Middle East, the more it's keeping its eyes off of the ball. Mm-hmm. And as a result, it needs to shift towards Asia. And combined with this, the realization that the Middle East actually has lost a lot of strategic significance. It had more strategic significance 20 years ago, but it has lost a lot of it because of many different reasons, including, of course, the U.S.'s own discovery of shale oil and the way the oil markets look, but also because the cost of being the hegemon of the Middle East has dramatically risen in the last couple of years as a result of the Arab Spring and the fact that so many states in the region right now are failing states. So it's really a sunk hole that just sucks out resources and energy out of the United States. And as a result, the United States needs to shift. The Iran deal was very, very much a part of this strategy because the one major issue that actually could grab the United States and suck it back into another war in the Middle East, the biggest risk was the Iran nuclear program. That's why it was important to resolve that in order to be able to proceed with the pivot to Asia. And many critics would say that the president has not done enough when it comes to that pivot. Mm-hmm. But it is not something that is just in his mind. It's also strongly held by a lot of people in the Pentagon as well, the need to be able to shift. The Saudis and the Israelis were completely against this because it meant that the United States would endorse a new regional order in which Iran also would be included and the U.S. would not be there to fight whoever the Saudis and the Israelis wanted the United States to fight.
Right.
But rather they would have to deal with these issues as independent states. They would still have the support of the U.S., but not this type of automatic support that whenever the Saudis are involved in a conflict, the U.S. automatically would be on their side.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. or that the U.S. would be involved in an all-out campaign to isolate Iran. The Saudis and the Israelis have held out the belief that this was just a little idea of Obama. And as soon as Obama leaves office, things will go back to normal, in which the U.S. will shift its alliances towards Saudi Arabia and Israel again. Mm-hmm. It will go for an all-out campaign of isolating Iran. If the Saudis have problems with Iran, the United States will move in quickly to support them. And it will go back to the way things used to be. I think that if President Trump clarifies that while the United States does not intend to lose Israel or Saudi Arabia as allies, but it is no longer going to waste so much energy and resources on the Middle East when there are actually much more important issues in the world. And it wants these countries to take the responsibility for the region, for their own region, step up. And as President Obama made clear to the King of Saudi Arabia, the United States intends to resolve its tensions with Iran, and so should Saudi Arabia, instead of keeping those tensions alive in the hope that it can drag the U.S. into that conflict.
Right.
If Trump clarifies this to the Saudis and the Israelis, and they finally adjust to it instead of fighting it, then I think actually there could be greater openings in which diplomacy could work and a new balance could be found. It will not necessarily be a happy balance, but it will be a balance compared to what we have right now, which is essentially total chaos in the Middle East.
As a final question, I know you need to run in a minute, but I just want to explicitly bring it in. So China, if China's that sort of rising potential hegemon from Asia, while we are bogged down in Middle East, they are playing a much smaller role there, but actually also kind of expanding this whole new landscape of really, I would say, almost like neo-colonial activity in Africa. And that's like a new landscape in terms of a globe of more limited resources and ecological problems. They're also sort of benefiting in terms of opening up a different map as well, while we're bogged in 1960s style problems.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. A Chinese official told a friend of mine that China's national security strategy is to keep the United States bogged down in irrelevant wars in the Middle East.
Right.
And the United States is quite good at doing so itself.
Right.
China has deliberately focused on areas that the United States is not particularly involved in order to not alarm the United States too much and keep it bogged down in the Middle East.
Mm.
Because if the Chinese started to go into areas where the U.S. is also very involved and sees as its key strategic areas, then that could actually cause an awakening and an abandonment of the Middle East strategy much sooner than otherwise would happen.
Well, Trita Parsi, I really appreciate your time. I hope your voice is heeded in these times. You have a smart and essential map, and I appreciate it. Hopefully talk with you again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Be well. All right, everybody. Bye. We are going to get to the fun half. We have a lot to cover. We have a lot of sound. We have a lot of stories. I can't guarantee you, frankly, how fun this half is going to be, but I will never lose my disdain, and I will never lose my snark. So it will always exist. We have a new Two Dope Boys in a Podcast dropping tomorrow. And I think our conversations on race, the changing demographics of this country, and businesses' role and inequality and how we design the economy are sort of terrifyingly more urgent in the environment we're in right now. We talk about New Balance aligning with Trump. We talk about how even businesses and brands in this environment can't be on the sidelines. Once again, a lot of new people have been subscribing, giving good feedback, and I hope you'll find us on iTunes or the NPR One app or on Stitcher and Twitter, Instagram, blah, blah, blah. JustCoffee.coop, Fair Trade Tea, Coffee, chocolate, use the Majority Report coupon code, get the Majority Report blend. Subscribe to the Majority Report if you haven't already. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. All of our content is on YouTube, obviously, as well as additional content sometimes as well. We're going to keep up with that. And write us a review on iTunes. If you must, use Amazon or Jet. Use our link. Skim a penny off for good. Take from evil and good to good. I saw Eric Schmidt on the street the other day in Manhattan. I was waiting to meet somebody. And I saw him walk by. And I almost was like, you cuck! Like, we were doing a shows about manipulating Google algorithms to manipulate the Democratic primary months ago. And yet, Breitbart beat you, you prick. I don't want to hear about Burning Man or maybe you dated Wendy Dang or whatever. You need to get back behind that computer screen and properly manipulate some neoliberal election results, you twerp. But I called Matt instead and said all that to Matt. So I wasn't in Chelsea calling Eric Schmidt a cuck, although I probably should have.
I wanted Michael to ask about the Epstein, I forget what his first name is.
I think it was Robert. Robert Epstein.
Robert Epstein told us about the Eric Schmidt is called The Groundwork. I think it's probably still live. It's like thegroundwork.com or something like that. And it has this very mysterious logo. And I honestly have been thinking about that every couple months, being like, this Hillary Eric Schmidt tech nexus scares the crap out of me. And then they go and lose the election to Donald Trump.
Yeah, exactly. That's terrifying. Except this like website that's like, birth control is making us a Mexican country. And now I'm a senior advisor to a malignant deranged narcissist. And we're going to try to do 21st century fascism. Great. That beat you. You Google morons. Get on the ball.
Only Mexico can be a Mexican country. I'd be surprised.
You'd be surprised.
I mean, just technically speaking, it's Mexico, so.
We should do like a rap genius version of joke annotations for you, Kelly. You could do like an annotation website for jokes. That would be fun. Let's get to the fun half. I got a call in and, my mistake. Yeah, it's 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. The IMs are on. See you on the flip side. Everybody else, Janine Garofalo tomorrow with tips on how to handle the holidays. Thanksgiving.